blood, betrayal, and a secret carved into flesh. In the brutal medieval courts of the Lycan nobility, an alpha king's fated mate wasn't the glittering queen sitting on the throne beside him. She was the mute servant, scrubbing mud from his boots. This is the story of a shattered crown. For centuries, the true events that transpired at Ironclad Keep in the bitter winter of 1241 were deliberately erased by rival bloodlines. It wasn't until the private, sealed journals of Lord Thomas of Kent, a trusted advisor to the crown, were unearthed from a collapsed crypt beneath Yorkshire that the real, terrifyingly passionate story came to light. The official history books will tell you that the reigning Queen Beatrice died of a sudden, tragic winter fever. Lord Thomas's diary, however, details a story of brutal deception, suppressed lineage, and an explosive fated bond that tore a kingdom apart. This is the account of Isolde. Isolde lived her life in the agonizing space between visibility and absolute nothingness. According to Lord Thomas's records, she was brought to the northern fortress of Ironclad Keep as part of Queen Beatrice's sprawling dowry. To the guards, she was merely a fixture of the cold stone corridors, a ghost in a coarse linen tunic who kept her head bowed and her mouth shut. Isolde had not spoken a single word since she was 7 years old. The trauma that stole her voice was a closely guarded mystery, but the rumors whispered among the scullery maids suggested she had survived a rogue pack attack that slaughtered her entire bloodline. Because she was utterly silent, she was deemed broken. In the ruthless hierarchy of medieval lycanthropes, a broken wolf was worse than a human. They were the lowest omegas, stripped of rights, meant only to serve. But Queen Beatrice's cruelty toward Isolde was not merely born of superiority. It was born of an unspoken, paranoid terror. Beatrice, a breathtaking but venomous noblewoman from the affluent southern Pax, had been chosen as King Gideon's mate for purely political reasons. They shared no fated bond, no celestial tether forged by the moon goddess. Beatrice knew that Gideon, the fearsome alpha king of the northern reaches, possessed a wolf that was perpetually restless, hollowed out by the absence of his true mate. To compensate, Beatrice ruled the keep with an iron, unforgiving fist, ensuring her status could never be challenged. And she kept Isolde close, not out of affection, but to control a secret Isolde carried on her very skin. High on Isolde's left shoulder blade, trailing down toward her spine, were a series of raised, silver scars. To the untrained eye, they looked like the remnants of a horrific burn. But Beatrice recognized them for what they truly were: the ancient, dormant stigmata of a true Luna. The marks of a fated mate, waiting to be awakened by the touch of her alpha. Beatrice did not know whose mate Isolde was destined to be, but she knew that a pure-blood female bearing those marks was a threat to every politically arranged marriage in the kingdom. To hide this, Beatrice subjected Isolde to endless torment. Lord Thomas's diary vividly describes how the queen forced Isolde to wear heavy, scratchy wool collars even in the sweltering heat of summer. She was assigned the most grueling, filthy tasks: scrubbing the blood-soaked kennels, turning the heavy iron spits over the roaring hearths, and emptying the chamber pots of the highest nobles. Beatrice wanted Isolde dirty, smelling of ash and sweat, effectively masking her natural scent from any alpha who might visit the court. Isolde endured the abuse with a quiet, stoic grace. She had accepted her fate. She found solace in the simple rhythm of her chores, in the cold bite of the winter wind against her cheeks, and in the rare moments she could sneak away to the castle's aviary to watch the falcons. She believed the marks on her back were a curse, a cruel joke played by the moon goddess on a wolf who couldn't even summon the voice to howl. Then the horns of war blew, echoing off the snow-capped mountains. King Gideon was returning. He had been gone for 3 grueling years, fighting the Highland Wars to secure the northern borders. The king was a legend of muscle, strategy, and ruthless violence. When he rode through the heavy iron gates of the keep on his massive black warhorse, the sheer, crushing weight of his alpha aura forced every servant, including Isolde, to their knees in the muddy courtyard. Peeking through the tangled curtain of her unkempt dark hair, Isolde saw him for the first time. King Gideon was terrifyingly magnificent. His armor was dented and streaked with dried blood. A thick, fur-lined cloak was draped over his broad shoulders. His face was a landscape of harsh angles and battle scars, but his eyes, a piercing, luminescent amber, held a profound, exhausted emptiness. As Gideon dismounted, Beatrice practically threw herself at him, draping her arms around his neck in a display of possessive affection for the watching court. Gideon accepted the embrace with rigid politeness, but his wolf was agitated. Lord Thomas noted in his journal that the king's first words upon returning to his ancestral home were not of joy, but of a strange, lingering irritation. He complained of a ghost scent in the air, something that aggravated his battle-worn senses. In the mud, just a few feet away, Isolde felt a sudden, violent, searing pain radiate from her left shoulder blade. It felt as though a branding iron had been pressed into her flesh. She gasped silently, clutching her collar, unaware that the proximity of the Alpha King had just ignited the dormant runes carved into her skin. The keep was plunged into a frenzied state of preparation. The arrival of the king coincided with the Feast of the Blood Moon, the most sacred and decadent celebration in the Lycan calendar. For 3 days, the stone halls of Ironclad Keep smelled of roasting boar, sweet mead, and heavy, intoxicating perfumes as lords and ladies from across the territory gathered to honor Gideon's victory. Behind closed doors, the tension between the king and queen was palpable. Beatrice was desperate to officially seal their mating ceremony beneath the blood moon, an ancient rite that would permanently bind their souls and solidify her absolute power, regardless of fate. Gideon, plagued by an unexplainable fever in his blood and the aggressive pacing of his inner wolf, repeatedly delayed her requests. "His grace was like a caged beast," Lord Thomas wrote. He snapped at his generals, refused his meals, and spent his nights wandering the freezing battlements, claiming he was searching for a scent he caught on the wind, a scent of crushed pine, rain, and wild honeysuckle. The queen, enraged by his distraction, took her fury out on the household. Isolde bore the brunt of Beatrice's escalating wrath. On the afternoon of the feast, Beatrice struck Isolde across the face with a heavy silver hand mirror, simply because the water in the wash basin was too cold. The blow split Isolde's lip, sending a trickle of blood down her chin. "Clean yourself up, you wretched creature," Beatrice spat, her beautiful face twisted in ugly disdain. "You are to serve the king's table tonight, and keep your collar pinned high. If I see even a fraction of your repulsive scars, I will have the guards flay the skin from your back." Isolde nodded, keeping her eyes glued to the floorboards. She bound her collar tightly with heavy iron pins, ignoring the agonizing, pulsing heat that had been radiating from her shoulder ever since the king's return. That evening, the great hall was a theater of excess. Hundreds of candles cast flickering, golden light over the long oak tables. Laughter, the clashing of goblets, and the rowdy songs of victorious warriors filled the cavernous space. At the head of the hall, seated on thrones carved from ancient weirwood, were Gideon and Beatrice. Gideon looked deeply uncomfortable. He was dressed in a tunic of rich crimson, a heavy crown of black iron resting on his brow. His amber eyes continuously scanned the hall, his nostrils flaring. His inner wolf was clawing at his mind, howling in a language he couldn't quite decipher. It was a primal demand, a visceral craving that made the fine wine taste like ash and the roasted meat taste like rot. Isolde entered the hall through the servants' corridor, carrying a massive, heavy silver tray laden with fresh cuts of venison and goblets of spiced wine. The sheer volume of people, the overwhelming stench of wolf pheromones, and the suffocating heat of the hearths made her dizzy. Every step felt like walking through deep water. As she approached the high table, she kept her head down, tracing the familiar grooves in the stone floor. She just needed to pour the wine, bow, and vanish back into the shadows. She reached the dais. She poured Beatrice's goblet first. The queen didn't even look at her. Then Isolde moved to the king, as she leaned forward to fill his heavy jeweled cup. A sudden, powerful draft blew through the great hall from a newly opened door. The wind caught the thick tapestry behind the thrones, but more importantly, it caught Isolde. For a fraction of a second, the heavy, sour scent of ash and lye that Beatrice forced Isolde to wash in was blown away. King Gideon froze. The goblet in his hand slipped, spilling dark red wine across the white linen tablecloth like fresh blood. His wolf slammed into the forefront of his mind with the force of a battering ram. Crushed pine, rain, wild honeysuckle. The scent was intoxicating. It was the purest, most undiluted essence of a mate he had ever encountered. It hit Gideon so hard that his bones actually cracked loudly in the silent hall, his body instinctively preparing to shift into his lichen form to claim what was his. Gideon's head snapped up. His glowing amber eyes locked onto the small, trembling servant girl standing beside him. Isolde, terrified by the sudden shattering of the goblet, instinctively stepped back. Her heart hammered wildly against her ribs. She didn't understand the ferocious, predatory gaze the king was leveling at her. It was a look that stripped her bare, a look that spoke of possession and ancient rights. Beatrice saw the exchange, her face drained of all color. Pure, unadulterated panic flashed in her eyes. "Clumsy fool!" Beatrice shrieked, her voice cutting through the suddenly quiet hall. She lunged across the table, not aiming to slap Isolde, but aiming to get between her and the king. In her frantic haste, Beatrice's manicured hand, adorned with heavy, jagged diamond rings, caught the neckline of Isolde's coarse woolen tunic. With a sickening rip, the cheap, worn fabric gave way. The heavy iron pins snapped. The entire left mouse-orve, Isolde's almost tunic, was torn downward, exposing her bare shoulder to the cold air of the hall. A collective gasp echoed through the great hall. There, glowing with a faint, ethereal silver light under the illumination of the blood moon, filtering through the high, stained glass windows, were the marks. Three intertwined crescent moons, wrapped in ancient vines, completely fully formed and pulsing with raw, unmistakable lunar magic. Lord Thomas wrote, "The silence that followed was heavier than death. Every alpha, beta, and omega in the room felt the shift in the air. We were looking at a sacred brand, a mark of the goddess herself." But more terrifying than the revelation of the servant's true nature was the sound that erupted from the king. A low, guttural growl started deep in Gideon's chest, a sound that vibrated the very stones of ironclad keep. The king slowly rose from his throne, towering over the table, his eyes entirely black as his wolf took absolute control. He didn't look at the queen. He didn't look at his stunned generals. He looked only at the trembling, mute girl clutching her torn dress, staring at the physical manifestation of his soul carved into her skin. "Mine!" the Alpha King roared, a voice of pure, terrifying thunder that brought every lichen in the hall violently to their knees. The word hung in the stifling air of the great hall, heavy and absolute. "Mine." According to the translated parchments of Lord Thomas's diary, the sheer force of the Alpha King's command shattered three stained glass windows along the eastern wall. Shards of colored glass rained down upon the feasting tables, but not a single lord or lady dared to move. They were pinned to the floorboards by an oppressive, terrifying gravity. The ancient magic of a soul bond demanding submission. Beatrice, however, was immune to reason, blinded by a frantic, clawing desperation to preserve her crown. "Witchcraft!" Beatrice screamed, her voice cracking as she scrambled backward over the high table, knocking over platters of roasted meats. "She is a practitioner of dark arts, a hedge witch who has painted herself with illusions. Guards! Lord Percival, strike her down! Sever her head before she curses the king!" Lord Percival, a hulking knight loyal to Beatrice's southern family, drew his broadsword. The scrape of steel against the scabbard was agonizingly loud in the silent hall. He took one step toward the servant girl. Gideon didn't even draw his weapon. He merely turned his massive, fur-draped shoulders and unleashed a snarl so ferocious that Lord Percival dropped his sword and collapsed to his knees, clapping his hands over his bleeding ears. Gideon stepped down from the dais, moving with a slow, predatory grace. The crowd parted like water, leaving only Isolde standing in the center of the debris. She was trembling violently, her thin arms crossed over her chest to hide her torn bodice, her breath coming in ragged, silent gasps. She squeezed her eyes shut, waiting for the killing blow. In her life, drawing the attention of alphas had only ever meant pain. But the touch that came was shockingly gentle. Large, calloused hands, scarred from years of brutal warfare, carefully grasped her trembling shoulders. The moment Gideon's skin made contact with hers, a shockwave of visible, silvery energy rippled through the hall. The burning agony in Isolde's shoulder instantly vanished, replaced by a profound, radiant warmth. Isolde opened her eyes. The terrifying, towering Alpha King was on his knees before her, ignoring the muck and spilled wine soaking into his velvet trousers. His amber eyes, previously wild and black with predatory instinct, had softened into a pool of liquid gold. "You are freezing," Gideon rumbled, his voice thick with an emotion the court had never heard from their warlord king. He unfastened his heavy, fur-lined royal cloak and wrapped it securely around Isolde's fragile frame, dwarfing her in his scent of crushed pine and rain. He reached out, his knuckles brushing the dirt-smudged line of her jaw. "What is your name, little wolf?" Isolde stared at him, her chest heaving. She opened her mouth, her throat working frantically, but only a dry, raspy exhalation escaped her lips. Panic flooded her features. She tried again, her hands curling into the fur of his cloak, but her vocal cords remained stubbornly paralyzed. Tears of frustration and terror spilled over her cheeks. Gideon's brow furrowed. He looked to the head of the royal guard. "Fetch Dr. Aldous, now." He then turned his gaze back to Beatrice, who was being restrained by two of Gideon's generals. The king's aura shifted from protective warmth to freezing, lethal ice. "You knew," Gideon said softly. His quiet tone was far more terrifying than his roar. You hid my fated mate in the squalor of my own home. You masked her scent. You beat her. She is a mute, Beatrice shrieked, weeping black tears of ruined makeup. A broken Omega. She cannot lead your armies, Gideon. She cannot sing the ancestral rites. The southern packs will rebel. Let them, Gideon snarled, effortlessly lifting Isolde into his arms as if she weighed no more than a bundle of dried reeds. If the south marches on ironclad keep, because I have claimed my true Luna, I will drown the valleys in their blood. That night, the political landscape of the kingdom was violently rewritten. Beatrice was stripped of her finery, bound in iron, and thrown into the weeping cells beneath the keep to await trial for high treason. Up in the king's heavily guarded chambers, the truth of Isolde's origins was finally unearthed. Dr. Aldous, the royal physician, examined Isolde's throat and the extensive scarring on her back. Lord Thomas sat by the hearth, recording the physician's horrifying findings. The girl was not born mute, doctor, Aldous reported, his hands trembling as he spoke to the king. Her vocal cords were damaged by a severe trauma, likely a crushing blow to the throat when she was but a pup. Combined with profound psychological shock, her voice simply retreated. But it was the identifying birthmark on Isolde's right wrist, a birthmark Beatrice had missed, that unraveled the greatest lie in the kingdom's history. It was a crescent moon pierced by a weeping willow. Lord Thomas recognized it immediately. By the goddess, he whispered. She is not a common servant. She is the lost daughter of Duke Edmund. She is the heir to the Silverpine Pack. The room went dead silent. The Silverpine Pack had been supposedly wiped out by rogue wolves 15 years prior. But the truth, pieced together from Beatrice's frantic confessions in the dungeons, was far more sinister. Beatrice's father, Duke Leopold, had ordered the massacre of the Silverpines to seize their lucrative silver mines. They had slaughtered everyone, save for a terrified 7-year-old girl who had been struck dumb by the sight of her parents' murder. Realizing a mute child could never testify, they kept her as a trophy, a slave to be humiliated by Leopold's vain daughter. Gideon, listening to this, shattered the solid oak mantelpiece with a single punch. His mate was not only a survivor of unimaginable cruelty, but she was royalty, wrongfully enslaved by the very family that currently shared his throne. Winter gripped ironclad keep, but the fires within the castle burned hotter than ever. The transition of power was bloody and swift. King Gideon annulled his arranged marriage, declaring Beatrice a traitor to the crown and a defiler of the moon goddess's laws. Yet history books omit the delicate, heartbreaking romance that blossomed in the royal chambers. Lord Thomas's diary is the sole witness to the Alpha King's profound devotion. Isolde, conditioned by years of abuse, was initially terrified of her new reality. She flinched when servants approached her, and she frequently tried to return to the scullery to scrub the floors out of pure habit. But Gideon was an anchor of unimaginable patience. He dismissed all servants from their wing. He brought her meals himself. He spent hours sitting on the edge of the great feather bed, simply holding her hand, reading to her from ancient leather-bound tomes and letting his calming pine scent soothe her frayed nerves. They developed a silent language of their own, a language of touch, glances, and the deep telepathic resonance of their fated bond. Through the bond, Gideon could feel her gratitude, her sorrow, and slowly, her blossoming love. But a kingdom built on violence does not surrender to peace easily. On the eve of the winter solstice, the official coronation of Isolde as Luna Queen, was set to take place. Word of Beatrice's imprisonment and impending execution had reached her brother, Lord Arthur of the Southern Valleys. Unwilling to lose his family's grip on the throne, Arthur orchestrated a desperate, suicidal infiltration of Ironclad Keep. During the solstice feast preparations, when the castle guard was distracted by the influx of visiting dignitaries, Lord Arthur and a dozen of his most elite, sent masked assassins breached the royal wing. Gideon was in his study, completely unarmed, reading a draft of a peace treaty, when the heavy oak doors were blown off their hinges as by black powder. Lord Thomas's journal describes the ensuing chaos with terrifying clarity. Gideon, shifting into his massive black-furred lichen form, fought with the savagery of a cornered demon. He tore through four assassins in seconds, but he was outnumbered and unarmored. Lord Arthur, wielding a longsword coated in lethal wolfsbane, managed to slash Gideon across the chest. The Alpha King fell, the toxic silver-infused poison instantly paralyzing his limbs, dragging him to the floor. Arthur raised his sword for the killing blow. Isolde had been in the adjoining bedchamber, dressed in a sweeping gown of white velvet for her coronation. Feeling the violent tear in their bond, she ran into the study. Seeing her mate, her savior, bleeding on the floor, the world stopped. For 15 years, Isolde had been a ghost. She had swallowed her terror, her rage, and her grief. She had accepted her silence. But as Arthur stepped over Gideon's paralyzed body, the dormant, suppressed power of the Silverpine bloodline ignited with the fierce, protective fury of a true Luna. Isolde threw herself between the assassin's blade and the king. She didn't flinch. She didn't cower. She opened her mouth and she screamed. But it was not a human sound. It was not a sound that required vocal cords. It was a psychic, ethereal howl, a manifestation of pure, unadulterated spiritual power. Lord Thomas, who was running down the corridor with the royal guard, wrote, "It was a sound that deafened the soul. The torches lining the stone walls instantly extinguished. The stained glass in the corridor shattered into a million glittering fragments. The shockwave of the Luna's roar hit us like a physical wall of force." Inside the study, the effect was devastating. The sheer magnitude of Isolde's supernatural command struck Lord Arthur and his assassins like a physical blow. Their inner wolves, confronted by the absolute divine authority of a true queen defending her king, submitted violently. The men collapsed to the stone floor, convulsing, blood dripping from their noses and ears, their weapons clattering uselessly away. Isolde fell to her knees beside Gideon, her hands pressing desperately against his bleeding chest. The glowing silver scars on her back pulsed brightly, and through the mate bond, she pushed every ounce of her life force into him, fighting the wolfsbane in his veins. By the time the royal guard burst into the room, they found the assassins incapacitated, the false queen's brother weeping in terror on the floor, and the mute servant girl fiercely cradling the head of the most dangerous alpha in the northern hemisphere. Gideon survived. Lord Arthur and his assassins were executed before dawn, their heads sent back to the southern valleys in pitch-sealed boxes as a final warning. Beatrice was quietly banished to a remote, heavily guarded nunnery in the freezing peaks of the jagged mountains, officially pronounced dead of winter fever, to avoid inciting a full-scale civil war with the remaining southern lords. This was the official lie the history books recorded. But the truth, locked away in Lord Thomas's diary, is far more beautiful. The day after the attack, Isolde was crowned Luna Queen of the Northern Reaches. She never regained her human voice, but she never needed it. She ruled alongside King Gideon with a profound, quiet strength, communicating her decrees through him, a king who hung on her every silent gesture. Under her reign, the laws regarding Omegas and lower caste wolves were rewritten, and the forgotten Silverpine territory was restored. She was the silent servant who endured the darkness, only to become the brightest moon the kingdom had ever known. The untold history of the Lycan Kings is filled with hidden truths and forgotten bloodlines. If you were captivated by Isolde's silent strength and King Gideon's fierce loyalty, hit that like button and share this video with your fellow lore enthusiasts. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell so you never miss another deep dive into the real, dark romances of medieval history. What historical mystery should we uncover next? Let us know in the comments below.